It's a great pleasure to be here, and the title is ND Lambda Graphs in Extremal Combinatorics. I think that normally you should avoid using Greek letters in a title, unless your lecture is in Greek. But I decided to make an exception in this case, and hopefully the title will make sense in a moment. So the general plan is here. I'll first define these graphs. Then I'll tell you something about their properties. I'll give examples and some applications. Let me try to alternate between the two overheads. So first, the definition. So we'll have graphs. All my graphs are finite and undirected. G equals V is a graph. V is a set of vertices. There is human descent. I always wanted to really be taller, but so V is a set of vertices, E is a set of edges, and the number of vertices is N. Now we can define the adjacency matrix of the graph, so that's the matrix A that you see here. Its rows and columns are indexed by the vertices of the graph, and in place AUV, what you see is the number of edges between U and V. Normally, my graphs will be simple, so usually this number will be either 0 or 1, and normally we'll have zeros on the diagonal, but maybe sometimes we'll have some loops. It will not really make any difference. Because it's an undirected graph, this matrix is symmetric, so it has real eigenvalues, and we can order them from the biggest to the smallest, and we'd know them by lambda 1 up to lambda n. And that's the main definition. An ND lambda graph is a graph with n vertices. It is D regular, namely the number of edges incident with every vertex is exactly D. And the absolute value of every eigenvalue besides the first one is at most lambda. Okay, so that's the definition. Now, some simple remarks are in order. The first one is that if a graph is D regular, then the biggest eigenvalue is always exactly D. It corresponds to the all one eigenvector. That's very simple. Another thing, which is not very difficult to prove, is that if a graph is D regular, then the second largest eigenvalue, now not in absolute value, but really the second largest, is always at least twice square root of D minus 1, with some error terms that goes to zero as the diameter goes to infinity. Okay, so if the diameter is 100, then the second eigenvalue cannot be significantly smaller than the square root of D minus 1. And another thing which is very simple, comes from computing the trace of the square of the matrix, is that if we have any ND lambda graph, and D, let's say, is at most N over 2, so it's not very close to a complete graph, then lambda is at least square root D over square root 2. So lambda can never be much smaller than square root D, and we see some examples that in many cases it can behave essentially like the square root of the degree. Okay, so that's the definition. And now the general phenomenon that I'll try to convince you when stating some properties of these graphs, although I'll not state all, is that if lambda is significantly smaller than D, then the graph is pretty much looks like a random graph. It has some strong pseudo-random properties. So I'll tell you now about some properties of those. And here is the first one. So this has to do with the edge distribution and the independence number. So this is a notation. It basically means that EBC for two sets of vertices of the graph is the number of edges between C. For some technical reasons, it's better to count ordered pairs BC, so that B is in B, C is in C, and BC is an edge. This just means that if B and C both belong to the intersection of the set B and C, then we count this edge twice. But you can think about BC as disjoint sets if you want. And then the basic fact is that for every two sets BC in an ND lambda graph, so incidentally in the coming, let's say, five or six transparencies, always the graph we consider is an ND. Okay? So for every two sets B and C, the number of edges between B and C is roughly what it should be. Now you see, this is what it should be because there are B times C potential edges between B and C. If the degree is D, then you can think that the probability of getting a single UV to be an edge is D over N. Right? So if the world would have been, the world would have been ideal, then the number of edges we would have between B and C would have been precisely B times C times D over N. Right? But then there is some error term, and this error term is governed by lambda. So if you want, lambda measures how imperfect the world is. And I thought that this is a very good sentence for the videotaping, because you can imagine in 500 years when historians will watch this lecture, they will try to make sense of this sentence that lambda measures how imperfect the world was in the 21st century. It could be nice, yeah. Anyway, so this is the error term. In fact, it can be improved a little bit by some other factor, but I ran out of space here. But basically, when you use it, it's convenient to use it in this way. And in particular, if you take B to be equal to C, then you get a lemma that we were using in some paper with Fen Chang. And that says that for every set of vertices, the number of edges in this set deviates from what it should be by this term here. So here I took the real error term set. The theorem just substituted B equals C. And in particular, this gives you that if the set B is independent, there are no edges at all in it, so it means that the error term here has to be bigger than what you see here, then you can just play with the numbers, and it tells you that the independence number, namely the maximum size of a set of vertices with no edges in the set, is at most n times lambda over d plus. That's an old result of Hoffman. I should say that it follows also this result from a more difficult result of Lovas about the Shannon capacity of a graph. Now, I don't want to define Shannon capacity, so it's another invariant of graphs which is motivated by information theory, and it's always at least as big as the independence number of the graph. And it also can be bounded in terms of the eigenvalues, and the bound we get is the same bound that we get for the independence number. Okay? So this is the first. The denominator here is d plus lambda. Yeah. Right. So, yeah, really the lambda here is the lambda n, is the smallest eigenvalue. So not always, when I write lambda, sometimes it's lambda 2 and sometimes it's lambda n, but, okay. Good, maybe I don't. So this was one property. Now, here is another one. As I said, there are many, and I certainly don't mention all, so this is just to give you the flavor of things. So the next one is what we call vertex expansion, the connection between expanders and eigenvalues. And the way I stated it here, it's a lemma in our paper with Vitaly Milman, and it's related to results by Fiedler and by Tanner. So it's somewhat different, and what it says is that if lambda is small with respect to D, then the graph is a good expander. What this means is that every set of vertices has many neighbors outside the set, okay? And specifically, what this says is quantitatively, whenever you take a set of at most half the vertices in an ND lambda, number of neighbors outside the set is at least 2 times D minus lambda over 3D minus 2 lambda times the cardinality of the set. So somehow, if lambda is smaller, significantly smaller than D, then you get many neighbors outside the set. And I should say that there is also some sort of converse of this. So a graph is a good expander, in fact, if and only if the second eigenvalue, lambda 2, is separated from the first eigenvalue. But here I just stated this one. Now here is another property. This is what is called the max cut. The max of the graph, the maximum size, maximum number of edges in a bipartite subgraph of it. Namely, with graph, we split the number of vertices to two parts, as you see here, and we count how many edges go across. Okay? Now, if the graph is random, what we expect is that about half the edges, if the cut is into two equal or roughly equal parts. And in an ND lambda graph, if lambda is significantly smaller than, do not get much more than this. So what is written here is that we don't get more than half the number of vertices plus lambda n over 4. Lambda is negligible to d, then this error is small. Okay. So another well-studied invariant of a graph is the chromatic number. That's the minimum number of colors required to color the vertices of the graph so that adjacent vertices get distinct colors. Okay. So here also we know something about the chromatic number in terms of this n, d, and lambda. So one result is, again, an old result of Hoffman. It follows from his bound for the independence number of the graph. Every color class in a proper coloring of a graph should be an independent set. So if the independence number is small, then the chromatic number is big. And what follows from this is the result of Hoffman, that the chromatic number is at least 1 plus d over lambda. Okay. Now, there is also an upper bound, so this is something that we proved with Michael Krivlevich and Benny Sudakov, and it says that the chromatic number of an ND lambda graph is at most some constant d over log of d over lambda. Well, there is this one term, just in case lambda is very close to d, you don't want to divide by zero, and maybe I assume here that d is at most n over 2. I don't want... And I should say that both of these bounds may be essentially tight. So there are some examples where the chromatic number behaves like this, and there are some examples where it behaves like that. And another related result, so if we combine some of the things we prove in that paper together with some results of Van Vu, then we can get a stronger upper bound which holds for the so-called choice number or least chromatic number of a graph. So what the statement that is written here says that if you give each vertex a list of some constant d over log of d over lambda colors, and it's an ND lambda graph, then always you will be able to color the vertices properly using the list. Each vertex will get a color from its list, and adjacent vertices will get distinct colors. Incidentally, all these properties, I'm just mentioning them, and probably I'll not return to them, so... Don't feel that you have to remember all of this, although you are welcome to try, but I'm not going to really use this too much. It's supposed to give you the impression that indeed if lambda is much smaller than d, then the graph behaves in many ways like a random graph. Here is another recent result, somewhat more complicated than the ones I mentioned so far by Krivlevich and Sudakov, and that... is probably, unlike the previous results I mentioned, is not tight. So that has to do with the Hamiltonicity of the graph. A graph is called Hamiltonian if it has a Hamilton cycle. A Hamilton cycle is a cycle that goes through every vertex exactly once. So it's a simple cycle that traverses all the graph. And what they prove is that if lambda is somewhat smaller than d, or significantly smaller than d, roughly d over log n, as you see, there are some corrections here, then g is Hamiltonian. So this uses a Posha rotation extension method, which is usually used when trying to prove that random or random-looking graphs are Hamiltonian. In fact, some analysis of it by Komloff and Semmeredi. I should say that it's plausible to conjecture that that something much stronger here holds, namely that it is enough that lambda is smaller than d over a thousand, let's say, to guarantee that it's Hamiltonian. This, for example, follows from a conjecture of Hvatal, an old conjecture of Hvatal, that says something that tough enough graphs are Hamiltonian, and again, I'm not going to define tough. Now, this conjecture, the trouble, so this conjecture of Hvatal is still open. I'm pretty sure it's false, in fact. And then there is a question that if something follows from a false conjecture, does it make it more likely to be true or false? It's not clear, right? It's an interesting philosophical question, but this one I think is true. Yeah, questions.
If I correctly understand Hamiltonianicity, this looks to be extremely not stable property. So assume conditions satisfied, and it's Hamiltonian.
Right.
It looks that you. It means that you may add one h, and lambda will jump immediately to be almost d, because it stopped.
No. I mean, again, you have to delete edges. So to delete edges.
You may have other.
That's so right, and it is true, okay. And it is. Yeah. So, in fact, it is true what you are saying. It follows from the fact that such a result is true that in fact any will contain many Hamilton cycles, not only one, but in fact many. So it is true. But right. Okay. Now, let's see. Here is another thing which is maybe not that simple. So that's about counting subgraphs. So again, we have an n d lambda graph, and we choose our favorite fixed graph, H, let's say a triangle. And now we look at this n d lambda graph at a set U of vertices, which is pretty big. You can think about all the vertices if you want, or you can think about half the vertices or something. So quite a lot of vertices. And we count how many of copies of the fixed graph H we see there. We can ask about induced or about non-induced. Here I wrote it for non-induced, just how many copies we see there. So it turns out that what we see is pretty close to what we should see. Now, what is written here is looks complicated, but this is what we should see if, the world would have been ideal, because d over n is the probability. So, again, the fixed graph that we are considering has maximum degree delta, has a S vertices and R edges, then the probability of getting an edge is like D over N. When we raise it to R, then this is the probability that some R fixed places are edges. And what is written here is this is the automorphism group of the graph, but doesn't really matter so much. So what is written here is in how many ways you can place the graph in the complete graph on M vertices. And the probability is that each fixed copy is a copy is what you see here. So we expect to get roughly this. And if lambda is somewhat smaller than d, namely if this inequality here is satisfied, then indeed you see roughly that many copies. So I wrote here some examples that if lambda is some constant square root d and d is pretty big, so these graphs have to be dense, then you see roughly the right number of copies in any big enough set of any graph with maximum degree delta. Again, questions or...
So you consider graph which D, which every vertex has D. H.
Right.
It's a maximum degree. It means that it's not so.
No. This is H, right? So this is the small graph H. I didn't say that all the graphs appearing in the talk will be N d lambda graphs. What's G is? Okay. Okay. But indeed, it's a good time to say.
But you use D, so you have this.
Delta. So again, for H it is delta, and for there is a big graph here G, and there is a small graph like a triangle
Subgraph
H. Yeah, and we count how many times it appears inside.
So, okay. I understand.
And that's, in fact, a good place to ask, to say that please don't hesitate to ask questions whenever something doesn't...
Too late.
So, yeah.
Don't, too late.
No, I was worried that you will have a sudden attack of being ashamed, so... okay. But you see it already.
You have a constant degree between
T and 2B. That's constant.
You mean for this... For G. Yeah, if the degrees of the big graph are different, even between D and 2D, or in fact completely different, then the only thing is that it's better to look then at the Laplace matrix in order to define the eigenvalues. So we have to look, because then it's not true anymore that D is the biggest eigenvalue. So you have to look at the Laplace matrix and to look at the smallest non-trivial eigenvalue of that, and then pretty much everything I'm saying would hold. But the formulas would look uglier, so I prefer to do it this way.
If the graph is almost regular, so basically the same result.
Right. Well, that also. Uh-huh. Okay. And good. And then maybe the last one in terms of properties is... the last one that I mentioned is about counting walks. So this is useful for some applications, and the way I state it here, the upper bound is really due to high-tight convolution semi-ready, but the tight bound here is by Nabil Kahale, and then the lower bound is in some paper with Feige, Victor Zon, and Zuckerman. And what it says here is that, again, you have an ND lambda graph. You take a set of vertices W, which you may think of as half the vertices, let's say, and now you want to count how many walks of length k you have inside W. What is a walk of length k is what you think it is. So we start at a vertex, and then we go to some neighbor, and so on. We are allowed to repeat vertices that we visited. It's not self-avoiding walks or something. We are even allowed to go back along the edge that we came from. And so essentially, what should have been the number of walks? I mean, there are W ways to start the walk. We just choose a vertex. And then for each next step, there are d possibilities. So it's w times d to the k minus 1. This is the total number of walks in the graph that start at w. Now, the probability that they stay in each step inside the set w is mu, right? And if, because mu is a measure of w, so if things would have been totally independent, it would have been w times d to the k minus 1 times mu to the k minus 1. And again, you see that the lambda gives you some error term. Say that again. That is true. Right. Good. So I should have lambda over d, and I should have a... I have probably somewhere.
Okay.
So people, thanks. Amazing. I mean, people are still actually reading what is happening here. Incidentally, in our paper, we prove the lower bound just for even values of k. So for some reason, it's easier to prove it for even values of k, but it's true for all values of k. In vertices, this way, right? K walks of K vertices, that's true. Okay, so as I said, there are more properties, but this hopefully is enough to convince you that if lambda is significantly smaller than D, then in many respects this graph looks like random. Now let's talk a little bit about examples. I mean, there are these famous stories about mathematicians who prove all kinds of properties for structures that actually do not exist. So here it will be nice to know that actually some things exist. And we have several examples. So here is a recent result of Joel Friedman. He talks about random d-regular graphs. D is fixed now. And it doesn't really matter much which model of a random deregular graph we take. This is true for all of them. And then it shows that with a high probability, so asymptotically almost surely, meaning with probabilities 10 to 1 as n tends to infinity, these graphs are nd lambda graphs, where lambda is essentially as small as it can be. I told you that the second eigenvalue must be at least 2 square root of d minus 1. So he shows that for every fixed epsilon, if n is big enough, with high probability, no eigenvalue, but the first one has an absolute value more than 2 square root d minus 1 plus epsilon. This was something that I conjectured. His proof is over 100 pages, so it's it looks very complicated.
He had a result close to that before, didn't he?
It's the other result. Which one?
Close to that on...
I thought you said other results that I mentioned. Yeah. So there is there was the previous paper. I mean, the first paper was by Shamir and Broder, and they proved some D to 3/4. Then there is another paper by Joel Friedman, and one by Kahn and Semeradi, and also the conference version by all three of them together, which proves a constant square root D, let's say in the Kahn Semeradi version, and some 2 square root d minus 1 plus something with log d. So some small correction by Friedman. But then he had to sweat for 90 more pages to get it down to epsilon. I mean, you see, if this is true even for 3 regular, for cubic. So it's really 2 square root 2 plus epsilon. And, okay.
What's the right value of the root term? It's just root of 1, or you can see more?
Something follows from the proof. It's actually interesting if the conjecture could be maybe that the epsilon is not even there, right? We know that such graphs exist with no epsilon. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Okay.
On the jargon level, I understand statement, but on precise note,
okay.
There exists a missing part, which is perhaps interesting in itself, because it's all finite numbers involved, so almost surely cannot...
So almost surely means, as I said...
Which may be probability, which may be very interesting.
Yeah, almost surely means exactly that for every fixed D and epsilon, if n goes to infinity, the probability goes to 1.
But this okay, so for when you say this, may be very interesting.
Right. I agree. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
It's also
D is constant here. Yeah, here D is constant.
If you bound epsilon from above, but for fixed epsilon, it could go to 0. If you're
sure. So for every fixed epsilon, it goes to 0 when n goes to infinity. So the question of Vitaly was how does it go to 0? Maybe one can get it doesn't go to 0 exponentially. So the trouble is that you can have some very small reasons why the eigenvalue drops. For example, if the graph is disconnected, then lambda is equal to d. Which is horrible. Right, but this may happen. Yeah, but this is with probability that is only polynomially small for fixed D, because you just have to change things in a small number of vertices. But anyway. Okay, now here are a few more examples. Let me hurry a little bit. So these are Paley graphs. We take a prime, which is 1 modulo 4. The vertices of the graph are the integers modulo p. And two are adjacent if and only if their difference is a quadratic residue in the finite field with p elements. You can take a finite field with a prime power of elements. So that's an example of what's called strongly regular graph, which is part of a bigger class of graphs which are called distance regular. For all of them, we can compute the eigenvalues exactly, and they would give other examples. Well, for this specific one, the degree is roughly, is exactly p minus 1 over 2, so roughly half the number of vertices. The eigenvalues can be computed precisely, and this lambda is as small as it may be. So I told you that lambda always is at least square root of the degree over square root of 2, as long as the degree is at most n over 2, and this is achieved by those Paley graphs. Here is another example that's the Erdős-Reiny graph. Sometimes it's called the Erdős-Reiny-Sosh graph. It really is a polarity graph of the lines versus points of the projective plane. Some similar graphs can be constructed from other generalized n-gons, generalized 4-gon, generalized 6-gon, but let me not talk about these. So this is a graph with, again, it exists for every p, which is a prime power, and it has p squared plus p plus 1 vertices. It is p plus 1 regular. It has a few loops, but we can ignore them. And again, the eigenvalues, we can compute them precisely, and it's an ND lambda graph where lambda here, again, is roughly the square root of the degree. And the important property of this graph is it doesn't contain a cycle of length 4. It is because through every two points, we have a unique line. So basically, it is... So far, these are relatively simple examples in the sense that it's pretty easy to show, to give the construction, to show that they satisfy these properties. Here are two somewhat more complicated examples. So the first are the expanders of Lubotsky, Phillips, and Sarnak, and of Margulis, so-called Ramanujan graphs. So for every D, which is prime plus one, really, we can do it for prime power plus one also, this was done by Morgenstern later, which is 1 modulo 4, let's say, there are infinitely many ND lambda graphs where lambda is as small as it can be, even no epsilons here, right? So lambda is 2 square root of D minus 1, namely all the other eigenvalues in absolute value are at most 2 square root of D minus 1. So this is one example, and here is another one. So that's a graph, a triangle-free graph, so a graph that does not contain triangles. It has n vertices. The degrees are about n to the 2/3. Lambda is, again, roughly the square root of the degree up to a constant. And the important thing is that it has no triangles. So the precise parameters, or the almost precise parameters, are written here. Now, as I said, in these cases, the proofs are somewhat rely on some more difficult tools, especially the proofs for the eigenvalues. In this case, the eigenvalues are bounded by using some results of Eichler and Iguza and what's called the Ramanujan conjectures that tell you something about the number of ways in which some integer can be written as a sum of four squares of a special type. And in this case, you use some properties of BCH codes and what's called the Karlitz-Uchiyama bound, which is really a special case of a veil theorem, the Riemann hypothesis for curves over a finite field. Now, the last example I want to mention are what we call projective norm graphs. So that's really a modification of what Kolar, Ronyai, and Tibor Szabo called norm graphs, but it's somehow a good modification. And here I even give you the precise description of the graphs. So again, you take a finite field with a prime or a prime power number of elements, that's GFP, and then you take GFP to some power, t minus 1, I denoted it here. You take the Cartesian product of the big field with the multiplicative group of the small field, namely the small field minus 0, and then two things are adjacent, so xA and yB are adjacent here, even only if the norm over the small field of x plus y is AB, where the norm is defined, you take x plus y, you raise it to the powers that you see here, p to the t minus 2 plus on plus 1. This is always an element of the small field, and if it is equal to the product of A times B, then these two things are adjacent. So the good thing about these graphs, and this was somewhat surprising to me, although in retrospect maybe this should have been obvious, is that you can compute eigenvalues precisely. It turns out that if you take a product of an additive group of the big field times a multiplicative, product of an additive character of the big field times a multiplicative character of the small field, then this is always an eigenvector of the square of the matrix. And there you can compute everything, and you get the eigenvalues in terms of some Gauss sums, where we know the values exactly. So these are ND lambda graphs, where, again, lambda is essentially, as I said, we know it exactly, but it's essentially the square root of the degree. Now, something similar is eigenvalues of the norm graphs. The norm graphs really are some induced subgraphs of these graphs. corresponding to substituting A and B equals 1. And there's eigenvalues can be estimated. There it's more difficult. You have to use some character, some estimates of the lean. And again, you'll get some similar estimate. You'll not get a precise formula. Say that again, a 2...
I mean, isn't this 2 good, or...?
No, yeah, because the degrees are very big. You see, the 2 square root d minus 1 is only when the diameter goes to infinity. So here, these graphs have diameter 2 or something. The degrees are very big. It was the same for the Erdős-Sereny graph. It was the same for... Right, so... Yeah. Okay, now, the important property of these graphs, and this is proved using some tools from algebraic geometry, is that they do not contain some complete bipartite graphs. So they do not contain KST, a complete bipartite graph with S vertices on the right and T vertices on the left, or vice versa, with all the edges, all the crossing edges, assuming that S is big, is at least T minus 1. Tutorial graphs, like in the Erdős-Sereny case, not contain something and still have good eigenvalues behavior. Okay, let me see how I manage in 8 minutes to tell you something about applications. So certainly I can talk hours about the applications many of the applications are algorithmic applications. You see a lot of the applications of expanders, which have many applications in sampling, in de-randomization, in constructing some codes, a lot of them really follow from the eigenvalues properties. So I'm not going to talk at all on any algorithmic applications. Now, other applications that you can use anti-lambda graphs for are some extremal problems. So you can show the existence of some graphs with some extremal properties, but in many cases you can do it also using random graphs. So sometimes it's good to have explicit constructions, but let's say that now I'm only interested in the extremal problems, solving them as extremal problems. So I'm not going to describe any application of these graphs where you can actually do it using, or where we know how to do it using random graphs as well. I only want to describe some applications where the spectral properties are essential, so we need these ND lambda graphs, we need the eigenvalues, and we don't know how to do the same thing using just usual random graphs. Okay, and now we... I have to hurry a little bit. So the first one is maximum cuts or maximum bipartite subgraphs in graphs of high girths, graphs that do not contain short cycles. So first there is this theorem of Edwards that every graph with M edges contains a bipartite subgraph or a cut, which contains somewhat more than half the edges. You see, it's very easy to see that every graph contains a bipartite subgraph with half the edges. At least you simply split the set of vertices randomly into two pieces. So this was used infinitely many times by Erdős, for example. But Edwards proved a precise version of that. So it turns out that always you can get half the vertices plus some constant square root m of the number of edges. And this is tight for every complete graph. Namely, whenever m is of the form k choose 2, you take a complete graph on k vertices, that's precisely tight. Now, it seems that you can get a bit more when the graph... maybe I should leave it here. You can get a bit more when the graph does not contain short cycles. It makes sense, because then it's sparser. You would think that you can get... So let's talk about graphs with no triangle. How much more we can get. Turns out that the error term somewhat... you can improve the error term somewhat, so we still can get in a cut half the number of edges, but we can get, instead of square root m more, we can get about m to the 2/3 more. This was proved by Erdős and Lovaas. Then it was improved, first by log factors, then by shear error, to about m to the 3/4, and then it turned out that you can further improve it to the error term to m to the 4/5. So you see that we have here this m to the 1/2, we can always get, then the 1/2 was improved to 2/3, to 3/4, to 4/5, This is an obvious beginning of some infinite sequence that converges to one. But you see, so here this ND lambda graphs come to the rescue, and it turns out that 4/5 is the truth. This is tight. And let me show you, because it's very simple, once we have one of these graphs. So I told you that we have this triangle free graph that has degrees about n to the 2/3, lambda about n to the 1/3. It is triangle free. The maximum cut, we already said that it is bounded by d plus lambda n over 4. We just plug in the numbers, and that shows that the m to the 4/5 is tight. So, of course, the main thing is the construction of this graph, which shows that the 4/5 is tight. Now, we can look at some bigger girls. Only we have to do it quickly. And we've done it recently with Bolobash, Krivlevich, and Sudakov. And it turns out that if the girth is R, namely the length of the shortest cycle is R, then the error term is always at least m to the R over R plus 1. And you see, for R equals 4, it is tight. For R equals 5, we can also show it's tight. And that is using the Erde-Schrenny graph, but now you have to modify it randomly, so it's a bit more complicated than this one. But again, we have to use those proper. We don't have to do it with random graphs, for example. We have some conjecture, but let me ignore this conjecture, because I want to show you some geometric problem, so to show that it's related to some other things. So that's a question of Lovas. It may sound a bit weird. Again, there is some motivation from Shannon capacity, which I'm not going to define, but let's look at it as a question in itself. So he's asking, how large can the norm of a sum of n vectors in the Euclidean space be if they are nearly orthogonal? So what is nearly orthogonal? Among any three of them, some two are orthogonal. Somehow this comes naturally from this Shannon capacity question. Now you see, you can take, if the vectors are pairwise orthogonal, then the norm of the sum is square root n. And the real question was if it can be significantly more than square root n. So this was solved by Konyagin first, who showed that it can be at least n to the 0.54. There is some specific number here. At most, n to the 2/3. It was improved by Kashin and Konyagin to n to the 2/3 over log n to the 1/2. And then turns out that the real truth up to a constant is n to the 2/3. And again, it follows quite easily from the existence of this triangle-free graph that I told you. And really, the proof... The proof is really here, but let me, I mean, as is usually the case, in the last 2 minutes I have the most interesting part, so let me not read this part, and I just say that again, it follows from the existence of this graph. Somehow look at the matrix, shift it, take a root, and... let me actually, I don't want you to even look at this. So... Let me talk quickly about multicolored Ramsey numbers. That's a very recent joint work with Vojta Redel, who just arrived today, I understand, or yesterday. So here is the definition of a multicolored Ramsey number. We have some fixed graph H1 up to HK, and then the Ramsey number R of H1 up to HK is the minimum number n, so that if this was a complete graph on n vertices by k colors, and for some I, we find a monochromatic copy of hi in the ith color. So here you see an example that the Ramsey number of triangle and triangle is C. We allow no more. Now I should be able not to look at the chairman for a while. So actually, what, 3 minutes? 3 minutes. I'll do it in 3 minutes. Okay. So a well-known theorem of Ramsey is that these numbers are all finite. Namely, if we take a big enough number for every big enough number r, and we call all the edges of the complete graph on r vertices by k colors, then for every graphs h1 up to hk, we'll find a monochromatic copy of some hi in the ith color. Now, these numbers, the exact value of them, or even the asymptotic value of them, is pretty difficult to compute for interesting families of graphs. And this is certainly the case with the right definition of interesting. So there are very few families for which we know it up to a constant factor. And I wrote here one example, that's a result of Itai-Komrus-Semre, this upper bound, and of Kim, the lower bound. If what we want is a Ramsey number of triangle versus a complete graph, then up to a constant factor, this behaves like m squared over log m. So if you take 10 times m squared over log m vertices, you color it by two colors, the edges, either you get a red triangle or you get a blue km. This is assuming the colors you used are red and blue. And if you take a bit less, then you can color it so that you will not see any of them. Now here are, so we have several new families. It's for multicolored numbers. In fact, for multicolored numbers, even less was known. And I just wrote here two examples. We have some infinite family of examples. So, for example, if you want the Ramsey number of a cycle of length 4, cycle of length 4, cycle of length 4, and Km. Okay, so it's a bit artificial, maybe, but this is one of the examples, four colors. And so the claim is that up to a constant factor, that behaves like m squared over log square m. Okay? Whenever you color 100 m squared over log square m by four colors, you color the edges of the complete graph, either you get a C4 in one of the first three colors, or you will get a complete graph on m vertices in the last color. And here is another example with K33. It behaves like m cube over log cube m. And then we can get several other examples, including one that was that solved the conjecture of Erdős and Sós. This was the motivation for looking at this. But, one word about the proof. So the lower bound, the upper bounds follow from some, it's also some probabilistic methods, but they have nothing to do with ND lambda graphs. The lower bounds come from taking some random shifts of appropriate graphs. And the important thing is to bound the number of independent sets of a given size in nd lambda graphs as a function of n, d, and lambda. And once we have that, then we can take some of the graphs, like the projective norm graph, say, and take some random shifts of them, do some probabilistic computation, and get these results. So I think I'll finish with this. I just wanted to say that certainly ND lambda graphs will have other applications as well, and it will be good, therefore, to know more properties of them. And just to mention one, that there are certainly some properties that we don't know, that we know for random regular graphs, but we don't know for ND lambda graphs. And here is just one of them. I have some more, but to mention this one, so suppose you have an ND lambda graph, lambda is small, D is pretty big. Is it true that it is what is called class one vising? So we assume that the number of vertices is even. Can we cover all of it by D matchings? Okay, a matching, which is just a collection of N over 2 isolated edges, and we want to cover everything by D edges. This is true for the random D regular graph, even for D equals 3 with high probability. It's not known here. It's not difficult to show that it is true, whatever that means. I don't want to define fractionally for those that didn't hear it. So with this, let me apologize for the extra 5 minutes, and I'll finish. Thanks.
Questions? Cheers, all. Send the speaker again.